Welcome to Dr. Cheryl's PodCouch, where we talk about all things parenting and mental health. Today, I am very excited to have on Cynthia, also known as Cindy Muchnick. Cindy is a graduate of Stanford University. She's an expert in the college admission process. She got her start in admission offices before opening a private study skills and college counseling business in Southern California, which she ran for over 15 years. As an assistant director of admission for the Illinois Institute of Technology and the University of Chicago, she screened and reviewed over 3,000 applications, interviewed prospective students, and served on the admission committee to evaluate borderline applicants and appeals cases. I cannot wait to talk to you about that. Then, as a private counselor, she helped hundreds of high school students navigate their academic journeys, including course selection, study skills, time management, and college applications. She has written the book, The Parent Compass, Navigating Your Teen's Wellness and Academic Journey in Today's Competitive World. Welcome, Cindy.
Yay. Thank you so much for having me, Cheryl. I'm so excited to talk to anyone who uses the word parenting and, you know, therapy and mental health in their podcast is my kind of person.
Oh, good. We are each other's people for many, many reasons. Let me say that I wish that people could see. I have lots of highlights in this book. I've highlighted here and highlighted there. I really did enjoy this book. It is bold to say that, oh, this book is a parent's compass. However, it really is. It really is. Bravo to you on writing an excellent, straightforward, very practical, very applicable book for parents, for caregivers, I think for college counselors, for anybody who kind of works with teenagers. So yeah, I'm really excited. We're going to dive in now. So I want to say that even right at the foreword, I have highlights. And, you know, not everybody reads a foreword of a book, although I do advise that they do, because a lot of times an author puts in their genuine thoughts in the foreword or introduction. But I'm going to read a little excerpt and we're going to start from there. So you write that you found that instead of being genuinely motivated and excited by their courses and activities, many of the students admitted to, quote, doing school, going through the motions, cheating, cutting corners, and ultimately not learning the material in depth. Most students felt overwhelmed or overloaded by homework, exams, extracurricular activities that interfered with their sleep and their social lives. The pressure to overachieve eventually took its toll on them and led to high levels of physical and emotional distress and exhaustion. Let's start there. Tell me, you've been doing this for a while. Was it always this way? Have you seen a shift? Tell me about this pressure and exhaustion you're seeing in these students.
Yeah, well, so, you know, that's kind of a heavy quote to begin with. But that being said, our aim, so I co-authored the book with a fellow colleague who's also a college counselor and has her background in social work as well, Jen Curtis. And the two of us have been colleagues for many years, both as independent college counselors, also known as educational consultants. And over the last, you know, 15 or 20 years, there definitely has been a shift that we both noticed as anxiety and depression was heightening amongst our students and stories that our students were sharing about classmates and their high school experiences. And if we could sort of pinpoint the time that this reached its peak, and the reason we wrote the Parent Compass, really one of the reasons, was in 2019 when the college admission scandal, also known as Operation Varsity Blues, occurred. I think that was really the tipping point or the inflection point. It was kind of the moment when the news headlines just showed that parents had really overreached and they didn't, you know, trust that their kids can, you know, navigate this process on their own. But in addition, obviously with the, you know, social media, you know, being introduced into the lives of kids, this sense of competing for college spots and a lot of pressure put on kids by their parents, we decided to write this book really as a reaction to not the fact that we were seeing every single kid walk through our office with these symptoms, but we did see signs of what really exploded in the college admission scandal. And yes, I would say those have been increasing over time. You and I can recall a generation ago that it was different when we applied to college, very different. Not only did we use typewriters and handwrite some of our college essays, but we didn't apply to, you know, 20 or 30 colleges. We didn't pack our resumes with all sorts of kajillions of activities. We had just a different lifestyle that we were raised in. And I just think that everything really has changed. And when it reached that boiling point, Jen and I just said, we need to do something about this that's more active than just working with the students in our office one-on-one. We need to kind of tell parents how to do a better job. So the book really began as an etiquette book. It started as a book to teach parents how to behave. And the title was not the Parent Compass originally. The title was a term that we coined called parenticate, parent etiquette. And then it got a little confusing in the, you know, in the studies when they were, you know, testing the book titles. And so it kind of evolved into the Parent Compass. And now it does seem to really stick in terms of, you know, of a guide to kind of navigating those tricky years.
So would you say that this Parent Compass is specifically for parents who are helping their teens navigate the college admissions process, or is it more than that?
It's definitely more than that. There's only one chapter in the book on the college admissions process. This is not a how to go through the college admissions process with your kid. They're one of our 13 chapters is on that. It's really a book of has parents how to do a deep self-examination and be ready to navigate shoulder to shoulder with your kids these tween and teen years. It really started as teen years, but it kind of has moved backwards to tween years. And I was doing an interview last week where the host told me that her fourth grade son is already talking about where he wants to go to college. Now, I don't know about you, but in fourth grade, even though I had older siblings, it was the word college wasn't even in my vocabulary. It was the farthest thing off in my life. I was thinking about the hamster that I wanted to get after school at the pet store. So, so it's just, you know, everything kind of has ratcheted back. I think whatever used to be the high school pressures have now become the middle school pressures, and whatever used to be the middle school pressures of, you know, everything's kind of petered down in my opinion. And you're probably seeing some of that in your practice, I would imagine.
I am, and I'm in Denver, where there's also a lot of pressure for private high schools. And so we see this, you know, definitely, you know, older elementary school, and definitely beginning of middle school, which is you have to do X, Y, Z, and you have to perform on the, you know, pre-high school placement exams in order to get into the right high school, so that in order you can get then into the right college. So it is a massive trickle down. Definitely not the way I was raised at all. And I'm wondering, like, you talk about the college admissions scandal of 2019 as being a tipping point where I think the whole country really had eyes wide open to, like, oh my gosh, like how egregious some of these things were. But prior to that, you were already seeing the stress, the pressure, anxiety, the depression. So is there anything that you and your colleague have pinpointed to? How did we go from in fourth grade, I care about my hamster or the next school dance or whatever it was, right? The talent show or something. How did it go from that to where we are today? Is there a different inflection point that happened even before 2019?
There is actually in the early 1990s, colleges hired PR firms to brand them. They, started becoming brands, and U.S. News and World Report came out around that time. And so college rankings also began. Another chapter we have in our book is how to interpret and not be overwhelmed and really avoid the noise of rankings. And those rankings quantified colleges by, you know, lots of flawed means. And we go into those in the book and the data and the research on it, on how rankings are manipulated. And that became kind of this like achievement point that parents wanted their kids to be on this magic list of colleges. I mean, there are over 4,000 colleges in the United States, 2-year colleges, community colleges, and 4-year colleges, private, public, whatever they are. And there's over 40,000 high schools, to give you an idea, when we were just talking about high schools. Why would private be better or different than public? And we could have a whole conversation on private versus public. I've had that before in presentations I've given. And I honestly think it's very similar to what we're learning from Challenge Success, which is an organization we love that actually wrote the foreword to our book. Denise Pope, its co-founder, wrote it, which kind of turns the idea of success on its head and takes it away from grades and test scores and the focus on that being the, you know, determining factor of success, and puts it more into, do you have a kid that can wake up in the day, get enough sleep, be happy, make their own decisions, you know, be mentally stable, all those kinds of things, and measuring success in different ways. So what the data does now tell us in a white paper from Challenge Success is that it matters more what you do while you're there than where you go. Yes. And there's, I recommend anyone go to Challenge Success website and read that 20 page white paper that they put together. And I would say the same thing about, you know, in terms determining what high school to go to. It really doesn't matter. It's what you're doing in the time that you're there, and, you know, the kind of person that you are and how you, you know, navigate that experience. So I would say those are maybe two big inflection points leading up to, you know, the idea that parents just really need to do this parent compass method, which is very counterintuitive because it's asking parents to back off, right? Mm-hmm. So we show our love and demonstrate our love to our kids by doing for them, by giving, by fixing, by helping, by managing, by hovering. And actually, we're doing them a great disservice to not have them feel the struggle, feel the pride of speaking up for themselves, feel the pain of failing something and then having to kind of go through it and come out the other side of it, because they don't develop grit and resilience and all these important skills if we're buzzing around them all the time. So it is this sense of kind of pulling back. And think about us a generation ago, our parents would say, come back when it's dark. Come back when it's dark, stay with your friends, be with a buddy. They would say that and stranger danger kind of stuff, but they would not say, you know, you got to do your homework. What time am I taking you here? It just wasn't a life that was so packed from 8 a.m. to midnight every day. It is draining. And you've written the, you know, the burnout book. So you know, you speak this language. It's just too much for these kids. And what we're doing is we're making it harder and we're making it worse, even though we think we're helping. So that's kind of what we're really exploring in the book.
Yeah. You know, do you think that there's, well, I'm going to ask a two-part question, one sort of cynical and one sort of hopeful. A, part A, do you think there's really hope that at least maybe any time in our lifetime, we will see the tide turn? And B, what do you think it's going to take? Because there are plenty of people that are preaching what you're talking about,
right,
but it feels like it's still the minority, and it still feels like the vast majority still competitive,
right,
pressure,
right,
these, you know, the ranking does count, the top 100 school, all of those things,
yeah,
really matter. So I'll let you answer that, but what do you think it's going to take, and are we ever going
to
see it?
Yeah, I hate to be a bit of a Debbie Downer, and you've posted about this on your platforms. It's really going to take a major overhaul, which the college admission process itself is a flawed process. I mean, it's described as a holistic process, but we know that it's imperfect. Our headlines are screaming about affirmative action right now. So, you know, the elimination of that is also impacting the college admission process. And honestly, the few ways to fix it, I think, would be to increase the student bodies at these various colleges instead of building all these buildings that house new gymnasiums and, yes, would bring in revenue. If you double the size of a class and could build more student housing and squeeze more kids onto those campuses, then you have more access. Now, how realistic is that for all these colleges to grow their classes? Well, the numbers have been so weird because of COVID and kids taking gap years and then coming back in, and the common application creates this opportunity for kids to apply to upwards of, as I mentioned, you know, 20, 25, you know, colleges. We see the headlines of the kids who apply to 80 colleges. I mean, it blows your mind the way this whole system is working. So I think there's got to be a way for the pendulum to swing back. I'm not hopeful and optimistic that it's going to be in this lifetime. I hope it will be, because I think this mental health crisis is really telling us something. And if we don't want to preserve the mental health of these kids and our relationship with them, then what are we here for? You know, they're not our trophies. We had our turn to be teenagers. We had our turn to live our journeys. Now this is their journeys. And if they feel seen and supported and heard and loved for what excites them, not what we think we want them to do vicariously, then the best we can do is start in our home, right? So those baby steps, that's, I think, the best way the change can start to happen. And my co-author, Jen Curtis, tells a story in the book about a student that she worked with. So we use case studies of kids we've worked with. We interviewed deans of admission. We interviewed therapists. We interviewed heads of school. we went to the experts and all their data, and we really pulled together what we think was the best information. And Jen talks about a story of a student she worked with who really had things together, seemed pretty relaxed, was going through the journey, did not seem crazy and overwhelmed, had some really nice choices that fit, you know, where she was, you know, wanting to head to college. And at the end of her time, Jen asked her, you know, what was it, you know, I'm curious, I'm raising small children, what was it that kind of helped you get through this high school experience without being so damaged? And she said, without skipping a beat, my parents made me do hard things. My parents made me do hard things, starting with tying your shoes and ordering your own food at a restaurant and telling the doctor how your tummy feels and checking in when you get to the dentist. And there's ways we can start to empower our kids from very young ages to feel that they have a voice and that this is their life they're navigating. And we're just there side by side to support them. Now, the other person we love to talk about is Mike Riera, who's also a head of a school, but also, you know, has a therapy background. I think he has a PhD in psychology, and he talks about in middle school, up until about middle school, you do manage your kids' lives. You drive them everywhere, you clothe them, you feed them, you bring them to their activities. Of course, that's a very natural thing. How could your kids do things without you, you know, intervening? But in middle school, if your kids, it's very typical that your kids will fire you as their manager, and that's very painful. And your goal is to be hired back as the consultant. You want to be hired back. You want them to like you enough to say, well, I want you involved. I just don't want you choosing everything. I don't want you managing everything. I want, you know, and that pullback and then that reconnection is very normal. But it's very painful, and parents take it so personally, like my kid no longer wants me. But what they're doing is what we want them to do, is spreading those wings and saying, I can do this without you. And you want me to do this without you, so that when I'm 25 or 35 or 40, I'm not, you know, calling you every day and on my therapist's couch telling them I can't do anything on my own because I've had my, you know, my mom or dad or caregiver right there doing it with me or for me this whole time. Anyway, yeah. I threw out a lot, but.
Yes, yes. No, all of that good stuff. I love that, right? You're going to get fired and hopefully you will get rehired as a consultant. I love that quote. I'm listening to you talk. I think that's one thing, what you just said at the end is one thing that parents don't understand, is that if you don't do the work now, you will pay for it in young adulthood. That it's just a different process, but then you have a kid who doesn't launch, or you have a kid who's having panic attacks in college, or you have a kid who fails out and they come home. And maybe one of the things we have to talk about more are the numbers of young adults who are really struggling and who really are back at home. You know, some, and certainly there's a mental health loneliness generation, 18 to 24. I'm listening to you talk, and I've already, like, I'm already drinking the Kool-Aid of, you know, how we have to teach our kids much more independence and fall and fail and just get back up. And, you know, I think that's hard, but maybe one of the angles is to talk about, maybe you can speak to this, when you worked at a university, what were you seeing in your college body? What was happening there even before the pandemic?
So I worked in a university a pretty long time ago. It was my first career out of college. So I will be straight with that. I haven't done college admissions for a generation. But strangely, I've been in the classroom because I've been auditing college classes for about the last 5 years. For my own personal selfish pleasure, I've been sitting in on some survey courses and just sitting in the back, taking it in with the permission of the professor. And strangely, some of the things I'm seeing, which aren't what you're asking, but which are shocking, are kids with laptops open that are on social media and that are shopping and that are like doing other things. And I just remember my notebook and my, you know, pen and paper taking my, like, why would you go to class if you're not going to actually engage in the class, right? So that lack of engagement, I think, comes from this teen burnout that kids just are like, oh my God, like another hour to sit through a lecture. But in, it's not, they're not all that way, but I'm at places that have, you know, relatively highly intelligent student bodies, and the kids aren't, you know, necessarily engaging in the classroom. So that starts at an earlier age too, by kind of supporting your kids through what excites them, right? So the subjects they like or the topics they like may be very different from what the kind of student you were or the way you approached material, but to let them know that, like, oh, I love that. Tell me about that. Teach me the things that excite you. The concept you're talking about, you know, the kids who come home after college, I mean, that's like the failure to launch, and there definitely are, but, and that's not my expertise, but what I'm seeing in my, you know, on the campuses are parents who are still setting their kids' alarms to, you know, waking them up in the morning and sending them Amazon packages every day and tracking them on their social media devices so they know where their kids are at all times. Now, none of us were tracked in college. If you have a new driver and you want to make sure they get from their first destination to the next destination, or in fact, my daughter even said to me, can you put me on that? Because when I'm driving, I want you to know if something happens that I got, you know, where I'm located when I'm driving in a car by myself. But to know where your kids are on their college campus or in their college experience, you know, I have a son traveling overseas right now alone. And I have asked him, could he just send me his itinerary so I know what hotels or hostels he's staying in on what days, so that if I don't hear from him, you know, I have a place to go. And he assured me, oh, my girlfriend back home is actually tracking me. So she knows if you have an emergency, she knows where I am. I'm like, great. I mean, there are certain opportunities and times when that's important for anyone, for a friend or an adult, and certainly as a parent. But I am seeing these kids that the umbilical cord has not been cut. Mm-hmm. And they're described on college campuses as teacups, as fragile. And there's a lot of alcohol abuse happening in college and a lot of depression happening there because these kids are finally like kind of let loose from the intensity. There's also a lot of lack of time management skills, because if you think about college classes as maybe a couple times a week and all these other hours in the day that kids need to fill, well, you have to fill it with studying and reading and doing your laundry and feeding yourself and exercising and those things, but they're not in practice because they've been on a hamster wheel from 8 a.m. to midnight all through high school, and, you know, and lack of sleep. So those are some of the concerns of what are going on college campus. The mental health on college campus is a huge piece. Every student launching and every parent should know where that mental health counseling office is, how much access they have to free therapy. I have a son in college who is an athlete, and I was shocked to find that there is one therapist assigned to 1,000 athletes who would need support because of balancing a load of academics and sports. And that's the service that's provided. So as parents, I think it's our duty. That's a great place to get involved, to understand, you know, if your child has a therapist in high school, can they continue virtually? Can they find someone local to support them? Or what does the school offer in terms of supplemental mental health? And colleges are aware that they need to provide that. It's just, what's their ratio of students to counselors, and how easily can kids get in?
I think you've done a great job of bringing to light the need that has to happen starting in elementary school, what it looks like as college students. I'm sure anybody listening to this would be remiss, and they might be like, why didn't you ask? I have to ask you one last question about, since you had this amazing position of reviewing applications and even ones that people were contesting. But one of the things that I recently heard, very recently, is they said, oh yeah, no longer do you want to put on an application that, you know, went to a third world country and helped, you know, build a school or whatever else, because that just says privilege. And so I heard somebody say that, and I just soaked it in, and I just thought, okay, so now where are we? So right. You can't say you're doing that, but then, so what do you, like, what truly, and I don't mean like theoretically, like, hey, guess what? I'm a really well-balanced human being, you know, but like, what really are colleges looking for today in 2023, which I know can change? What is an ideal college student anymore?
I think the word you're searching for is authenticity. Because we certainly know if we send our kids to a country to help build a school or help bring clean water somewhere, that costs money to send our kids on that trip, even if it's through their church youth group. And there's nothing, certainly nothing wrong with serving the world. Absolutely. However, everything can start locally. Everything we're paying all this money to send our kids far away or to take classes on college campuses. We have colleges right near where we live. Or community colleges where your kids could take a class. There are needs right around your community where kids can insert themselves and help. And so, I mean, the think locally, act globally idea to me seems to work really well. I mean, if a parent is fooled into thinking that sending your kids to a summer school on a college campus is going to help their odds in getting into that campus, you are greatly mistaken. It's a business. Colleges are businesses. And of course, they're going to, you know, these are not select, these are pay to play, unselective summer programs. If you want your kids to have an experience on a college campus, that's great to see what it feels like to live in a dorm and, you know, use a dining hall and just get their feet wet on a, you know, sort of have a pretend college experience, I guess, while they're in high school, but they're in high school. So I think what colleges are really looking for are, you know, if you think about it, this is the depressing part. There's, you know, 40,000 valedictorians and 40,000 captains of the swim team and 40,000 heads of the yearbook and 40,000, you know, newspaper editors. So what's different, right? So what's different that excites your kid? And that's really easy to find if you engage with your kid, as opposed to saying, I think you should do this. And I think you should do that. And this quote looks good for college. Cause I think that colleges for some, you know, can kind of see through that. It's human people like me on the other side that are reading the applications. We don't blame kids who are privileged. We don't come in, you know, looking for reasons to, you know, like punish people. It's not like a, but they have to find reasons to deny because there's way too many applicants. So, you know, grades and test scores and how kids do in school. And I would say grades and their academic rigor is kind of the first line of defense. It's your transcript. That's sort of the first thing. What courses did you take? How much did you stretch yourself? What kind of student were you? And where do you sort of fall in the category of kind of being a highly motivated, you know, academic student to just your kind of middle of the road, which I think are the best kinds of students because they're not wound so tight and there's room to grow and they've made those mistakes along the way. And there are colleges for all of them or experiences that aren't college after high school, which is the last chapter of our book. So I would say, you know, colleges are trying to find those granules of authenticity and to make sure that the puzzle makes sense. So they're putting this little puzzle together. They only have like 5 minutes to read your kid's application that they have taken hundreds of hours to prepare. So in that, they're looking for a voice in their college essay. They're looking at their grades and test scores. They're looking at their teacher recommendations. And then they're saying, what did you do with your free time? And if your kid is miserable on one of these programs or unhappy in a club they're a part of, get out. Don't do that. Do something else that brings you joy. Go on a run or take a nap even. Do things for your mental health that, you know, allow you, you know, the balance that these kids also kind of need. So it takes courage, and I know you're in the thick of it, you know, with your clients, but probably with your own kids too, Cheryl. It's overwhelming because the parents around you are creating this frenzy. And if you can let that fall like water off a duck's back and get the parent compass, start a book club or bring it to your book club and find like-minded parents that you can build your little parent compass community and say, you know, find a parent at another school who has kids who are older that you don't feel you're competing with, that you can kind of share this journey and say, what can we do in the best interest of our teens so we can preserve their mental health and preserve our relationship with them? Because ultimately, when they leave the house, that's all that's left is that relationship that you've built with them. That's what the takeaway is.
I love that. I think that's great advice. I think that if you are a middle school parent or you have a freshman, I love the idea, and I do. I talk about this a lot when it comes to social media kind of contracts. Like, you're not going to get the whole entire, you know, sixth grade class to agree to not, you know, start a TikTok account, but you might get your kid's closest three or four friends.
Yeah.
And that's all that matters, because if you can have a small, tight group that's really close to you as a parent or as a child who are doing, making like-minded decisions, who are, you know, holding the same values, life is very doable. It's yeah. when you're the only one whose parents aren't, you know, getting the private tutor and the essay coach and then this, and you're taking the SAT. That's the other thing. They're taking the SAT and ACT three, four times. All of those things, and they're looking for places with super scores. If that's what you're surrounded by, then of course you're gonna completely drink that Kool-Aid. Yeah. If you're in a really different place, I will tell you, my daughter says to me, it's hard. I'm gonna tell you that it's very hard. She's just finished her freshman year at a rigorous school, and it was really hard. Like
in high school or college?
High school. Uh-huh. High school. Very challenging, right? And really, we thought, I think maybe we're making the wrong decision by going here. This is a lot. But my attitude was very like, hey, I want you to be really balanced. And I want, and in some settings, that's hard. It, I don't know that it served her initially. My intentional, relaxed attitude about, hey, you get to start high school. I want you to be involved in sports and clubs and be nice to everybody and be friends with everybody. And, you know, the end of the first trimester, she said, well, I did a lot of those things. I was in sports. I was nice to everybody. I feel like I have a lot of friends. There's no social drama. But yeah, those academics, hard, you know, and so I guess I'm being honest in saying that I have put out that energy and it's not easy. There's going to be a trade-off. I guess that's what what I would summarize. And yeah. I don't know if you feel that way, but there is a trade-off.
You can read the Parent Compass. Jen and I talk about all the mistakes we made too. We are not perfect. There's a lot of gray areas. There's a lot of tough decisions as a parent or a caregiver that you have to make. And it's very case by case. I have four kids and four entirely different high school experiences and mental health experiences. And so much is environmental. So if your daughter is telling you, listen, I'm as hard as this school is, I'm happy waking up. I've made some nice friends. I feel good in my skin. Then to me, that's the goal. Then the goal has been met. And you obviously can, you know, can read it as things go. And it's going to be up and down. It is a roller coaster. That's for sure. But I think the things you shared with me, Cheryl, sound like you're doing the good Parent Compass things and you're, you know, putting those into her head and she hears that. But yeah, I just think I wish in this podcast we could solve more problems, but I do think that the Parent Compass is a start and starting small and building your small village is key. And you're very lucky if your daughter's telling you those things. You are very, very lucky. She may wake up next week and not say the same things. And then you've got a different, you know, a different peak or valley on the roller coaster.
I mean, yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, for anyone listening who has not yet read The Parent Compass, I really do want to say that you cover a lot of different topics. You talk about social media. You talk about one thing that I love. This is exactly what I say to the kids that I work with and to my own kids is school is your job. That is your job right now. I have my job. You have your job. You are a student. And I want you to look at it as such, right? And not that you necessarily said it like that, but you have a section about like school is your job.
Yeah.
You know, I don't hear a lot of people say that.
Now, some people disagree. They think school is where you get all your life skills. And I still think that, you know, your parents wake up and do what they do every day. This is your job right now. And I do think I like to view it that way because you have your coworkers who are your peers and you have your teachers who are your bosses and you have to learn how to please all of them with in different subjects that may come easier or harder to you with different personality types. And that is all like your training ground for sure. But yeah, it's definitely your job. And I'm glad that you support that. Not everybody loves that, but I do. So I do. That's right for me.
Well, I support it, not even just in theory. I genuinely believe that. And I think you should, and I tell my kids too, you know, lots of people, adults, hate their jobs. I don't want you to hate your job. Right. I don't want you to hate your job now. I don't want you to hate your job in 10 years from now. Yeah. I don't want you to hate your part-time job right now. Like, life is too short. Yep. I want you to like and hopefully really like or love your job, whatever that is in whatever age and stage. So, Cindy, thank you so much to you and to Jen, who I know is not on here, for writing the Parent Compass. I really want to support the idea that starting a little book club about this and finding your people who will use this as a compass, I think would serve parents extremely well and ultimately serve their kids.
Well, I love to travel and visit schools. So if you want me to come to Denver, I'm coming. But we try to give presentations for parent education committees. We try to get book clubs going. And on our website, which is parentcompassbook.com, you can click on the book club area and there's a book club guide, a free guide that can guide you through readings with a book club. And if you put in your information, Jen or I will zoom in to your book club and share in the conversation with you. There's no charge or anything. We just kind of come and participate at the end. And that's been really fun. We did a lot of that through COVID and got to hear from readers and parents who are, you know, living the adolescent parenting journey.
Love that. I think people need to take advantage of that. I think that is a huge asset. Cindy, thank you so much for coming on. And for anybody listening, please rate, review, and subscribe. All of those things mean everything. Thank you again for sharing the Parent Compass, and I wish you all the best in spreading the good word.
Thank you.